You know I'm a big fan of enjoying life while still being smart financially. That's why I love ButcherBox. I can get a variety of high-quality meat, seafood, chicken, and pork at an amazing value, all with exclusive member deals delivered to my door with free shipping always. One thing I just never wanted to cut out of my spending plan is eating good food. And with ButcherBox, I don't have to, and neither do you. Where else can you get free protein for a whole year? Yes, you heard that right. One of my favorite go-to dinners is a salmon bowl. I'm not even a huge salmon lover, but ButcherBox's wild-caught salmon is oh so good. I make a nice little marinade, saute some veggies, cook the salmon, and throw in some Weiss. And it is an amazing dinner. If you want to take less trips to the grocery store and always have prepared meat in the freezer for a lot less money, you need ButcherBox in your life. Sign up at butcherbox.com/ETM and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/ETM. I'm going to be real with you. Identity theft is on the rise, and you do not want to wake up one morning and discover that your bank account has been emptied, or you're overdue on credit cards you never even applied for. We talk about this often on the podcast, but you don't realize how much of your information is available to scammers on the internet and how susceptible you and your family are to identity theft and fraud. I know, it's scary, but now you can get your data removed with Delete Me. That's why I personally choose Delete Me. Delete Me is a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I just started using Delete Me and I got my regular personalized privacy report. I was shocked what they found and removed. It was pages of information about me that I did not want online. Here's how it works. You sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt to have Delete Me. And you know, it's also a great service for your parents or grandparents to help protect them from identity theft. Delete Me is not just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you do not want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special price for my listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use promo code ETM at checkout. The only way you get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and enter code ETM at checkout. joindeleteme.com/ETM. Go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use code ETM for 20% off. Raise your hand if you like snooping on other people as much as I do. Nothing malicious, of course, but there's something about having a behind-the-scenes look at people's lives that is exciting. And when it comes to investing, who wouldn't want to know how others invest their money? Brian Portnoy, behavioral finance expert and co-editor of the book How I Invest My Money, will take us on a little snooping adventure in this episode to look at how others invest their money.
You're listening to Millennial Money with award-winning money expert and serial entrepreneur, Shauna Come to Game, where we flip the script on the old school approach to everything your parents never taught you about money. Each week, Shauna creates a safe space by talking with special guests from around the world about money wellness, entrepreneurship, traveling like a boss, and what makes millennials tick. Unique stories, trailblazing perspectives, tips, tricks, and everything there is to know about money. Find it all here as you uncover your money story and unlock the life you want to live. Pretty cool, right? Here's Shauna, money expert, Indiana Hoosier, and burger aficionado.
Hi, my friend. It is so good to have you here. And yeah, I have to admit a little something. I like to snoop. My favorite thing to do is to go on a walk at night and look in houses to see how people live. Don't let your mind go racing. This is really an innocent, I promise, guilty pleasure done completely in a PG manner, but I have this feeling I'm not alone on this one. There's something about looking at other people's lives. It's the premise behind why we use social media, right? Or our, what do we call it? Addiction, right? Our addiction to social media. And since we don't openly talk about money, it's difficult to know where other people truly stand. So if we're going to talk about investing, the number one question you always ask me over and over and over again is, how should I invest my money? What funds? In real estate? Should I buy cryptocurrency? What about gold and silver? You name it. Well, the book How I Invest My Money was born from a blog post by Joshua Brown at his The Reformed Broker blog, answering that very question that so many other people wanted to know. And this blog post went viral, and Joshua and Brian teamed up to pull together 25 chapters from money experts talking about how they invest. So by the end of this episode, you'll learn about Brian's investment journey, and you'll hear tons of other interesting takeaways from this very insightful book. So let's get into it. We're here to talk about a lot of different things, but in particular, your new book, How I Invest My Money, which is this really cool collection of short essays from experts who are in the money field, who have devoted their careers to helping other people with their money. And I know this all came inspired by a blog post by Joshua Brown, your co-editor. The blog post was called How I Invest My Money, and it really went viral. And I think it's an interesting idea because so many people want to know, how do the money people actually do money and what trips them up? So I thought we'd just start with, you know, why do you think this blog post really went viral, and why is this book ultimately resonating with people?
Well, the easy answer is that everyone's pretty nosy. And everyone likes to know what everybody else is up to. You know as well as anyone that money is an emotional lightning rod, and issues of status and envy and curiosity and anxiety are kind of just wrapped up with it. So, you know, when there's the opportunity to kind of see and hear what other people are doing, and, you know, including so-called experts who have devoted, you know, their careers to being financial advisors or portfolio managers, I think it raises eyebrows. So yeah, Josh's blog post in mid-2019 was very well received. And, you know, he and I right after that talked about maybe getting together a group of friends and peers to, you know, for a collected group of essays.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's such a interesting idea. And if you let me indulge for just a moment, you talk about the emotions around money, which is something I really want to dive into. I talk a lot about mindset and your money story and how that basically impacts, you know, the decisions that you make about money. And your essay, I'd love to read the first two paragraphs because I feel like a lot of people can relate. You said, "My parents fought about money all the time. It's not that they were lacking. My dad made good money. My mom was good at spending it. They didn't seem to like each other for many reasons, and money served as this language of conflict and a currency of control. Following the divorce, issues of alimony and child support extended the unpleasantries for decades. Fast forward to recent times, I'm sometimes asked what I learned from my parents about money. The short answer is nothing, which I love. A longer, harsher answer is that money is a tool to buy things and to hurt others." And that, it really impacted me, those words, and I think so many people can relate to that. You know, how do we balance this relationship with money, this tool that you say to buy things, but then also it's used to hurt people? Like, how do we rationalize that out?
I think before we rationalize it, we have to, oh man, where to start? I mean, first of all, you know, the brain is hardwired to make terrible decisions on all things money. Like the brain is wired to survive and thrive in difficult times. And so, you know, money life, which is really complicated and noisy as a subset of this really big, noisy world we live in, it's overwhelming. So I I speak to lots of crowds, work with lots of clients, and I really like to actually stay away from the word irrational and just say that we're normal and that we're human. And I do think there's an element of validation that happens when, you know, people like you and me who kind of have some paperwork and some maybe some credibility in the world of financial decision making, you know, we can say to others, it's okay to find this scary. It's okay to, you know, acknowledge that there's a lot of anxiety around it, because, you know, the old school definition of money from seventh grade, you know, unit of account, store of value, means of exchange, like that's like nonsense. You know, what money is sort of one of the most primary ways in which we relate to other human beings. It's arguably the most important form of trust that exists among all humans, because you and I can fly halfway around the world, and if we have the right color piece of paper, we can exchange it with a complete stranger who will give us what we want. So it really sits at the root of kind of our social relations. And it's no surprise that there's a whole stack of emotions, some of them good, hope, aspiration, you know, positive stuff, alongside, you know, some of the more negative stuff. But you can't you can't have the good stuff without the bad.
Yeah, I like that explanation a lot. And I think that's obviously where most people struggle. And I'm curious about your thoughts on this. But, you know, I find, especially since I started doing this podcast, but I knew this reality long before, we don't talk about money with anybody. And I think particularly when we're maybe just starting out in our 20s, even our 30s, but heck, it could be any age, we can feel like we're in this bubble or this shell that only the mistakes we've made exist and nobody else can relate to that. And so, you know, it's I'm always trying to figure out, you know, how do we begin to develop this language around money so it's okay to talk about all the good things, but then it's also equally okay to talk about when things didn't go well, or maybe you spent money on something that just didn't work out. You know, I'm always curious about like how we actually develop this language where it is okay to talk about these things.
Yeah, I think about this a lot too. And, you know, there's that element of validation that I referenced. There's also an element of permission where, you know, you as a CFP, me as somebody who, you know, has an investment background and is now, you know, very wrapped up in the world of applied behavioral finance, which is a fancy way of saying practical tools to make good money decisions. It's important for us to, you know, say to others, but also not just lecture, but to engage in conversations that, you know, create a trusting environment where, you know, you can really talk about these things. And maybe that could come across as a little bit dramatic, but the fact is that money is the least popular topic. It's the most stressful topic that anybody has. You know, you go to the American Psychological Association, they do polls all the time, and what are the most stressful items in people's lives? And money tends to rank at the top of the list every year, above and beyond religion, politics, marriage, divorce, Wow. You name it.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah.
So something's going on, and it's been going on for a long time. The world of social media is not helping, you know, for the, I think at this point, obvious reason that just everybody is in everybody else's business. And so, you know, you can see what's going on. You can begin to, I don't know, observe things that might not be entirely true. And one thing's for certain, like, it's relatively easy to see others' assets. It's almost impossible to see their liabilities. So you've got a whole world of people who are just fronting their assets but hiding their liabilities. And so no one really knows what in the heck's going on out there. But we all then sort of extend the stories in ways that sometimes make ourselves feel worse.
Yeah, I so agree. And I think, you know, reading a lot of these essays, obviously people talked a lot about their money story. And that's another topic I try to talk about a lot on this podcast. I'm curious, you know, what are some ways that we can go about, like, if we've never thought about our money story or maybe how it's impacting us financially, what are some of the ways we can figure out, like, sort of, I guess, unpack or unravel what that is and then how that's maybe impacting good or not so good in our money decisions or, you know, keeping us from goals, whatever it might be?
Yeah. It's a really good question, and there's so many different ways to go with it. The first is just sort of table setting in terms of what I call money life. At least in the world that I live in a lot and come from, money and investing and finance sort of go together a lot. So, you know, sometimes when people like you and me talk about money, you know, others think we're talking about stocks and bonds and making a lot of money on, you know, Tesla or Bitcoin or stuff like that. But in fact, money life has numerous dimensions. So not just investing, but saving, spending, earning, borrowing, giving, you know, in the charitable sense. And so, you know, I think what we can be doing is providing vocabulary, concepts, and mental models to people to at least help them make sense of the world. I mean, the first thing we want to do from a almost a sociolinguistics point of view is create the right categories for people to be thinking in. So just pointing out that money life has all these different dimensions, and we know them. Like, no one's surprised that saving and spending and borrowing are all part of it. But like, okay, here's the playing field. Here's what's going on. And then from there, you know, we can begin to get into questions like, you know, straightforward stuff. What are your earliest memories with regard to money? Was money a source of, you know, was it a good or a bad topic in the home? Did your parents seem to have the same philosophy toward the different elements of money life? Like, where were the struggles? Where were the good parts? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to go, but just beginning to, you know, go back in time and think about, you know, if money, among other things, is kind of a culture or a cultural habitat that you live in, and one that's given to you, not one that not one that you choose, for the same reason none of us choose the, you know, the broader environment in which we're raised and develop. But like, what was that situation, and what did you observe? I mean, some people, you know, especially in the field of financial therapy, they go way down the path because people have had traumatic experiences. But even if we don't cross into that world, you know, we can ask people to think about kind of the good, bad, and neutral in their memories of things that money were attached to.
Okay, listen, like many of you out there, I love Notion, our sponsor today. And I honestly use it every day for my notes and journaling. I also track our family expenses, and I manage all of our household to-dos. Notion has been such a lifesaver in helping me get a lot more organized, because that's not one of my strengths, without stressing me out. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. Notion is the AI-powered workspace that can summarize things like meeting notes and automatically generate action items and help you get answers to questions in seconds. It will honestly blow your mind. Notion is for everyone, whether you're a Fortune 500 company, you're a freelancer, you're starting a startup, or you're a student juggling classes and clubs, or you're somebody like myself that just really wants to get organized. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/ETM. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/ETM, and start turning ideas into action. And when you use our link, you are supporting our show, notion.com/ETM. Okay, friend, I want to know, what are your money goals this year? Are you saving to buy a house or maybe a wedding or a dream vacation to somewhere tropical? If that's you, please, please take me with you. Or maybe you want to just grow your emergency fund because, let's be real, life is expensive. I want to make sure you reach your goals, so you need Monarch. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Here's what I love. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard. You can go between light and dark mode. You can create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up all of these automatic rules for your transactions and notifications, and so much more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving their product. Get this. They release updates every 2 weeks, and they even allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. This, my friend, is totally original. Plus, they will never sell your data to third party or show you ads. I think that's really important. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it is the top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this show get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial. In those moments when money is just not moving as fast as your dreams, Earnin provides the financial momentum you need to keep moving forward. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you access up to $100 a day as you work, and you can leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. I honestly would use Earnin in lots of different ways, but what's on my mind recently is I need a night out. I need some good tacos to sip on a few virgin margaritas and celebrate you all helping this podcast earn 26 million downloads. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. Gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in "Talkin' Money" under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. "Talkin' Money" under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank & Trust, member FDIC. The weather is getting warmer. I'm so excited, and it is time to say goodbye to all those jackets and sweaters, and hello to the shorts and t-shirts. I wanted to update my summer workout wardrobe for the long haul without, you know, spending a fortune. Luckily, I found Quince, and I am in love. Quince is your go-to place from everything from premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless, 14-karat gold jewelry, and so much more. The best part of all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes those savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. Okay, I bought the dreamiest pair of workout leggings and a bright pink workout top to match. Honestly, ladies, I gotta tell you, these leggings you need. The price cannot be beat, and I feel like $1 million wearing this cozy workout friendly outfit. I've worn it for like 5 days straight. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/ETM for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/ETM to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ETM. We have an Ask Shauna, and this one comes from Emily. And Emily says, "Hi, Shauna. My husband and I are moving to a smaller city in a different state for his new job, where the cost of living is lower.
Salaries tend to be lower in this location as well, but thankfully my husband will earn a similar salary. I will actually keep my salary as well since I'm fortunate enough to continue working remotely, and we currently pay a somewhat average rent price for our area for a 2-bedroom, 1,200 square foot apartment in the suburbs, about $2,000 a month. We're struggling with what to pay for rent in this new, more affordable city. We certainly won't plan to pay the same amount, even if we can technically still afford it. However, having a nice apartment with some amenities makes me feel a bit better about the move overall and working from home indefinitely. When we look at what we can save versus what luxuries we can afford, it's hard to strike a balance. Do we go for the cheapest apartment and make some sacrifices to save almost $10,000 a year? Or do we treat ourselves to something a bit nicer that still fits the dream apartment vibe without breaking the bank, still saving a few thousand? We recognize this is a pretty good problem to have, but we just can't figure out how much we should strive to spend versus save. Looking forward to your wisdom. Thanks. Emily, yeah, I mean, come on, this is such a great problem to have. You are right on the money, but this is also a dilemma that so many people face. It sounds almost silly to talk about it in terms of a dilemma, but this is really where money gets in that gray area, right? You just aren't sure what option is better. And so it's about trying to figure out pros versus cons. So honestly, I think you can't go wrong with this decision either way. It all comes down to, I believe, your values and how your decisions line up with those particular values. So when I say values, I mean, what is important to you both? Like really, really important to you both. And I think it's okay to splurge from time to time, especially since you're renting and not buying. If you were buying, I would say we really got to pin down what that is, because spending more versus spending less definitely has a quite profound difference, but renting's a little bit different. And I did this when I moved to the beach for a year and a half, about 5 years ago now, I think. I was like, I want to live by the beach, and Jeff and I weren't married yet. And so I found this amazing apartment. It was in this really cool complex in Long Beach, California, and it was the best decision I ever made. There were 6 different condos. It faced the ocean. I had an ocean view outside of my condo, and we all became like family. I've never had an experience like that before. And it was expensive, and it was definitely a luxury, and I only lived there for about a year and a half. But it was such an impactful decision. I would never take it back. I would never, ever take it back. In fact, that's actually where Jeff and I got married, facing the ocean in this beautiful courtyard outside of our complex. So the moral of the story is, sometimes it's okay to splurge. But either way, you're still going to save money, I think, which is always a win. And I would just say, make sure you have a plan for those savings so it doesn't just sit in your bank account. We talk always about that black hole in bank accounts. So even if you think you're going to save a couple of thousand dollars, somehow it just evaporates if we don't have a plan for that money. So have a plan, automatically withdraw that money, send it different places so that you can really use that money in powerful ways. But here are a couple of things to think about. Number one, how are you set up for your emergency fund? Where are you at? Do you have at least a couple of months of fixed expenses saved? Or do you maybe need to beef that up a little bit more? What are some of your money goals for this year? And where are you in terms of those? I realize we just hit a new year, but for example, if you want to try and indulge in a trip towards the end of the year, provided we can all travel, hopefully we can all travel by the end of the year. And let's say that trip will cost $5,000. Where are you in terms of saving for that goal? So just think about your goals and think about where you are in terms of saving for those, I would say, more immediate goals, goals that you really want to hit in this year. And then what does the next 1 to 3 years look like for you, as best as you can tell? And would either decision deter those plans for the next 1 to 3 years? You mentioned your jobs. How steady are your jobs? You know, what would happen if one of you did end up losing the job? Would you be okay if you were in that higher monthly rent? Just a little food for thought. And lastly, I think about what you would ideally do with that extra $10,000 versus the few extra $1,000. And if at the end of the day, it doesn't make that big of a difference, but you really would rather splurge and live in that little bit more indulgent place, then I don't think there's anything wrong with going for it if you've thought about all of these questions, right? Money decisions don't always have to be practical, but they must align with your values and your goals. And that is where you can't make a wrong decision if you're thinking about it that way. So as long as the higher price place isn't getting in the way of you paying your bills and moving closer to your goals, then I don't think it's a bad decision. But again, this is up to you. So really just spend some time thinking about this and let me know what you decide. I'm super curious. I'm just curious, how did you make your way into being really excited about the, you know, the mindset feature around money?
Yeah, that started about 10 years ago, I'd say. I mean, going way back, I did a doctorate in social sciences. And so I studied politics and economics and sociology and history. And a lot of it was kind of around kind of capitalism and the social institutions that make for capitalism. So I'll stop boring you and your listeners right now on that. But I guess I've thought
that's a whole other podcast episode.
Yeah, I think so. But I've thought pretty long and hard about like markets and society and the relationship between kind of individual aspiration and how that fits into society. So that's the background. And I decided not to go into an academic career. I ended up just being really interested in the markets and worked for a company called Morningstar that I'm sure you know of and some of your listeners do, based in Chicago, where I live, doing investment research. And, you know, just kind of figuring out good investments and writing about things like that. And then around 2010, 2011, just almost by accident, I stumbled across the field of behavioral science and behavioral finance. So read a book called The Art of Choosing by Sheena Iyengar. I mean, the book literally changed my life. I mean, it was just sort of one of those, like from a movie or cartoon, like that light bulb moment, where I reimagined investing less as a financial problem and more as a decision or choice problem. And from there, you know, Kahneman and Tversky and Thaler and Ariely and so many others. And, you know, here I am 10-ish years later, and I find this stuff as fascinating as I ever have because there's so much to learn. And when you map some of the new disciplines in neuroscience and evolutionary psychology and other fields into all of this, you realize that when we're talking about money, what we're actually talking about is what it means to be human. And I can read and write and talk about that all day.
You and me both. We yeah, could grab a coffee yeah. and have a very long conversation post-COVID.
Yeah, post COVID, my days will be filled with coffees with people like you.
I look forward to those days. You talked about these four money buckets in your essay that I really liked, and I want to talk about one of the money buckets. Everybody else is going to have to pick up the book to read the other three, but you talk about this idea of juicy cash, which really caught my attention. I'd love to know, you know, like why is juicy cash one of your four buckets? You know, what do the listeners need to know about having juicy cash?
Yeah, you know, I've used that term casually for like a few years, and I put it in my essay without really thinking much about it. And it's probably what people ping me about the most. I mean, on the one hand, it sounds like a really bad like sweatpants, you know, like fashion lineup. So there's a prior, let me answer your question, but take a prior step, which is that one thing I pointed out in my chapter, but a pretty large percentage of other contributors alluded to is that they hold, quote unquote, too much cash. So, you know, there are models that tell you, you know, you should have X percent in stock and Y percent in bonds and Z percent in cash. And the cash stake is never supposed to be very big because there's, you know, at least on paper, or at least statistically, productive uses for that capital. You can earn, or that cash, you can earn a rate of return on it. People like me, we often have 10, 15, even 20% of our entire net worth in cash, which is like really not good according to any traditional model, because I could be getting, you know, I could be making, you know, nowadays 0% on my cash or 1%. Because, you know, over, you know, we have the lowest interest rates in basically 500 years. So,
you know,
yeah, savers are being punished in a way that they never have before. But the reason I hold cash is there are multiple reasons. One is, my human capital and financial capital are highly correlated, meaning that I work in the markets generally defined. So, if markets go way down, it also means that my job stability goes way down. And if not my job, then my, you know, my customers or potential employers. So, you know, I cash up to have a more stable lifestyle. And I just like the feeling that, you know, if bad stuff happens, my wife and kids are going to be just fine for a period of time. So that's the context in which this juicy cash notion comes from. And precisely because I hold, you know, too much cash or more cash than a sort of a rational economist would say is prudent, I've looked far and wide for ways to make a little bit more on the cash, because, you know, you could make, you know, a fraction of a percent or effectively zero in a savings account, or you can look elsewhere. And, you know, as I point out in that chapter very briefly, you know, have found some municipal bond investments that I guess we could call them bond or fixed income, but they're very short term. They're liquid. There's, you know, just I'll spare you and your listeners the details, but very little credit risk. Despite the fact that it sounds like there might be if you kind of go through the documentation. So I'm very comfortable putting a fair amount of cash in that strategy. And so instead of earning 0%, I make, you know, 2 to 3%, which might not sound like a lot, but, you know, I'd rather make 3% on $1,000 than zero. Rather have 30 bucks than 0 bucks.
Yeah, I'll take 30 over zero any day.
Yep.
Well, there's so much great information that each of these people share. Are there any other, you know, essays or really consistent money themes that emerged that like really stand out to you?
Oh, totally. So, one nice thing about the book, and I'm proud of it for a bunch of reasons, but you know, one is that I think it's really user-friendly. It's 25 chapters each. No chapter, I think, is more than 5 pages. So you get these short vignettes from serious money people. And what Josh and I did at the outset, Josh Brown, my co-editor, was just, you know, go to the group of people you see on the list. And we said, read Josh's blog. I had written my version of it. Read my blog. And here's a blank piece of paper, and you get 1,500 words to tell your money story. There was no direction. There was no nudge or, hey, you're an expert in this, so you should talk about, you know, that. In fact, we told people, this isn't a commercial. This isn't an opportunity for you to tell us about, like, how you invest other people's money. This is how you invest your own money. And so what was remarkable was how disparate the chapters are. You know, some people don't even in a word mention anything about their investments. They just talk about the life that they've lived and how money has been a source of both, you know, a joy and sadness and, you know, depending on the essay. So one of the themes is that there was no theme. Everybody came back just with a very personal story. If you read Bob Seawright's chapter, which is one of the earlier ones, he spent the entire time talking about a lake cottage that's in his family that on paper would be a terrible investment because it's falling apart and it can't be winterized and all this other stuff. But it ends up being the place in his life for, you know, four generations of his family to spend time with. So how does he invest? He invests in this house because it creates the life that he wants to live. So what I think's beneficial, especially for people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, is to see the variety of life experiences that people have. And, you know, we've already gotten a ton of great feedback on the project. And I was hoping this would be true, and it is, that everybody I've talked to has found one or two chapters that really spoke to them, where it's like, oh, she's just like me. Or, oh, he reminds me of this. Oh, I didn't know you could do that. Like, oh, I do that too. Maybe I'm not crazy. But whatever the experience is, that, you know, we go back to validation and permission and even empathy. You can kind of find some fellow travelers and realize that money is value laden, and how we save, spend, invest, borrow, give, even the jobs that we choose to earn a living. Those are all just so closely wrapped up with our, not just our values, but our identity, like who we are. And money, to some extent, becomes both an embodiment and expression of our identity. And that's a good thing if you understand that and can channel it.
Yeah, I so agree. One of the essays that really stood out to me was Leanne Miko's. She's actually a personal friend of mine. And I know her story, but I think what she wrote is really powerful. And I don't want to spoil too much for anyone who's going to pick up the book, but she talks about this idea of net worth not being self-worth, and that money for her, even as an expert, has never been a pleasant topic. You know, this is something I've struggled with myself, and I know a lot of listeners have as well. And we've kind of talked about this in circles, but you know, what would you say to those listeners who are really stuck in that trap of, you know, maybe they're got a lot of student loan debt, or the net worth side of things just doesn't look as great, especially this year, could be anyone as great as, you know, you'd want it to be. And that somehow they're tying that to, you know, I'm not worthy, or whatever those words might be. You know, how do you separate those two?
Well, it's hard. I mean, the first thing we need to acknowledge and embrace is that it's really hard. And sometimes it feels like we're failing, but we're not alone. And I'm really glad that you flagged Leanne's chapter, because it, you know, I'm not supposed to play favorites, but it's really one of my favorites. I mean, and she and I had, you know, I think a pretty powerful exchange about it, because she revealed a lot about herself, and she said it was a bit of a transformative experience for her to put all of that, not only put it on paper, but then put it out into the world. And I just, you know, loved being able to get to know her a little bit. She, you know, we've some mutual friends. I didn't know her prior to the project. Maybe I can answer the question constructively by saying that one thing that is consistent across mostly all of the contributors is that they have a semblance of a plan. That doesn't mean they have sophisticated portfolios with fancy investments. It doesn't mean that, you know, they're doing some strange municipal bond strategy that I invest in. Forget all of that. That's actually noise. The signal is that having a plan is better than not having a plan. And secondly, there are lots of people in a variety of ways who can help you along that journey. It could be a friend. It could be a financial advisor. The financial advice business, in the broadest possible sense, and that ranges from, you know, stockbrokers on one hand to financial therapists on the other, and a dozen different types in between. There's a wonderful opportunity for people to find an expert of some form who can help them understand what it is they're up against. And as you allude to, you know, there is just some on the ground, real world dollars and cents issues. You have too much student debt. It's overwhelming. The interest is accumulating. What are you supposed to do? It's look, it's hard. It's really hard. But precisely because, going back to our original point, that money's so hard to talk about, we're often scared and embarrassed to ask for help. What I would say is ask for help. Find somebody or a community or a cohort that understands where you're coming from and can, to some extent, help. Look, if you owe $1 million and you make $20,000 a year, I mean, it's an absurd example, you're kind of in a bad spot, right? Like, so, sometimes there's no avoiding the math. But for even for people who have sort of a normal, difficult situation, there are often things that you can't and won't think about on your own.
Yeah. That's such great advice. And, you know, there's so much in this book, even that I walked away with, you know, again, just to having people being able to share their stories. You know, how can somebody who pick up the book, reads the book, you know, how can they figure out what is shared in the book and then figure out like maybe what to adopt in their lives? Like, what do you want the readers to translate into their own life?
You know, it's a good question. It just referencing back to something I said a few minutes ago, it might be the case that when you go through these chapters, and again, it's 25 five-page chapters. This is not heavy lifting. As you go through the book and you find that one or two, the one or two contributors where you say, huh, they're just like me, or their story resonates with me, push yourself hard to ask why. Why are they just like you? Why is this resonating? Is there something, because everybody in the book's pretty successful, you know, in the world, in the narrow financial sense, which isn't to say that many people in the book have had like incredibly difficult upbringings. I mean, the person in the book, I mean, I won't spoil it, but the person in the book who currently, here at the end of 2020, is probably by far the wealthiest person, somebody who has gargantuan sums of money currently. He grew up homeless and partly homeless and lived in the back of a car for 3 years. So he tells his story in a way that's, you know, that's powerful. But I guess find who resonates with you, push yourself hard to ask why, and then see if there are lessons or paths or even a few breadcrumbs you can follow to say, oh, okay, this is what they did, or this is where they ended up. And even if they don't tell you how they ended up there, you might say, ah, I'm here, they're there, I want to get there. How did they do that? And to the extent that you can't sort of infer from the chapter, that's when you reach out for help and say, huh, this person seems like they're like me and they ended up in a situation that I'd like to be in. How do I make that happen? And you know, as well as anybody, like, it's so hard to talk about this, but if you can find yourself in a cohort or a community or in an advisory or coaching relationship where someone takes you and your problems seriously and can demonstrate both technical competence as well as empathy, man, you're in a good spot. Like, you're going to be able to fight, and there's a good chance you're going to be able to win.
I love that. I love that. We're going to be able to win. Well, Brian, this has been so fantastic. I feel like I could talk to you for hours and hours. I would love for you to tell listeners where they can go to connect with you and also where they can go to pick up a copy of the book, How I Invest My Money.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it appears we only have one bookstore left. if you have a local bookstore, please buy it through them. But otherwise, Amazon is the place to go. And for me, I guess the two places to track me down, one is Twitter. Actually, financial Twitter or FinTwit is, notwithstanding all the BS on Twitter, FinTwit is a really warm and welcoming community where people share ideas and help each other out. So I'm at Brian Portnoy, just my whole name, at Brian Portnoy. And then I own and run a financial wellness platform called Shaping Wealth. And so the website is shapingwealth.com. And that'll give a little bit of high level information as to the programming and technology that my team and I are building to help people achieve financial well-being. And if, you know, anyone wants to get in touch with me, they could do that through, you know, through the website.
I don't know about you, but I thought it was super exciting to hear behind the scenes how other people invest their money. And I read How I Invest My Money, and I learned a lot from the book. And it was just really exciting to read about other people sharing their money stories, particularly finance experts, because I think when you do that, it's so powerful. You realize how much we all are so much alike. So definitely check out the book and pick up a copy. And if you love this episode, do me a favor, share it with a friend, share it with a family member, get them excited about investing. And I will see you back here in a few days for a brand new episode.
Hey, you. Yes, you. Before you go, we want to say thanks for listening to this episode of Millennial Money. For all the links, tags, and ads you've heard on today's episode, check out the show notes or go to mmoneypodcast.com, where you'll find more episodes to share with your friends. While you're at it, leave us a review and make sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you don't miss out on all the money tips and tricks that will take you from a millennial regular to a millennial money expert. See you back here in a few days with a fresh new episode.